Nancy Garter, and I'm the weather and climate reporter at the Omaha World Herald. And it's really a privilege for me to moderate this panel. I've enjoyed very much getting to know the panelists over the phone. And let me get to the right page here. We have talked about where they're from and what they do, and one of the things that I've enjoyed in talking with them is coming to appreciate just how committed each of them is to what they believe in and where they want to see their area head. The Conservation Reserve Program is one of the crucial pieces to how we manage our private lands. I'll start with introductions of our speakers. To my immediate left is Scott McLeod. Did I get that right? Scott McLeod, Government Affairs Representative for Agriculture and Conservation and Biofuels Policy with the northern region here of Ducks Unlimited. And to his immediate left is Paul Johnson. And Paul farms, and he was the head of the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, in Iowa. And under the Clinton administration, he was a head of the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and is intimately familiar with CRP policy and its ramifications. And to his left is Brian Jennings, who is the Executive Vice President of the American Coalition for Ethanol. And so I want to thank them for agreeing to participate. And then just really quickly, I don't know how many of you all are familiar with CRP, so I'll just do a really quick rundown of what it is. And then they'll each talk about 5 minutes or so, and then we'll go to a couple quick questions from me, and then go directly to your questions. And I left my notes at home, I apologize, so correct me if I hope the panelists will correct me if I make mistakes here. But the Conservation Reserve Program is about 20 plus years old, was organized in the mid-80s, and initially started as a program to help farmers in some price supports and grain production. It has evolved into broader than that in its mission, and has become a way to restore biodiversity to farmlands and improve water quality by trapping pollutants before they leave the farm and beyond that. I believe that for most of its time, it's been up around 40 million acres. And it's been an important source of income on farmland. In the 2008 Farm Bill, with record grain prices and a great demand for more production, that acreage was significantly reduced to about 32 million. And there's conversation now: should we take it down further, or should we remain at 32? Did I get those numbers correct? Okay. And so what we're seeing then is a current change in the program, and this is what we're going to be talking about. Where do we go from here? So and of course, one of the great pressures on the farm, both in demand for land and potential benefit to farmers, is the demand for crops to feed ethanol. So we've got a great panel here, and I won't delay any further. We're going to go left to right, and so Scott will begin.
Can everybody hear me? All right. Thanks, Nancy. I don't know if some of you that came in late, I've got a little handout here just to kind of help people follow along. It's right up front here. Just some graphics to kind of orient you as I go through some of my comments here. Just a little background on DU, for those of you that don't know. We're the world's largest waterfowl and wetland conservation organization in the world. We've got over 675,000 members just in the U.S. alone. We have sister organizations in Canada and Mexico, DU Canada and DU Mexico. Our mission is obviously to conserve, restore, manage wetland and associated habitats for North America's waterfowl. But we also recognize that these habitats are also beneficial to other wildlife species as well as the public. Our focus with CRP is mainly on the Prairie Pothole region. That map on the front page there, for those of you that aren't familiar with the U.S. portion of the Prairie Pothole region, kind of outlines that. And that is one of our highest priority landscapes. It's a glaciated region that has a high abundance of wetlands, a lot of diversity in the wetlands. There's a map on there that also shows, you know, the density of wetlands and the different types that we've got across the landscape. That's a map from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, their National Wetlands Inventory. And obviously those wetlands are what attract the ducks in the springtime. And a lot of those areas will attract more than 100 breeding pairs per square mile. So our densities are fairly high in wet years, particularly like this year. And you might wonder why, since we're talking about ducks, why we feel that CRP is so important. But the grassland habitats are just as critical as the wetland habitats. The grasslands are where they nest. Those birds, very few of them actually nest in the wetlands. There are some overwater nesting species, but most of them are up there in those grass habitats. So CRP, native prairie, those types of habitats are very important. Those grasslands also protect the wetlands from sedimentation and nutrient and chemical runoff as well. In 2006, I think Nancy mentioned that some of the acres in CRP. In 2006, the program kind of peaked at about just over 36 million acres. There was 36.4 million acres in the program, and there was about 8.1 million acres that are actually in the Prairie Pothole region at that time. Starting in 2007, USDA recognized there was about 28 million acres of that 36 that were going to expire from 2007 to 2010. And roughly 6.4 million or 79% of the acres in the Prairie Pothole region were set to expire in that time period as well. So obviously a big concern for us. In January of 2007, USDA, the Farm Services Agency, offered contract extensions and re-enrollments on all 28 million of those acres that are expiring. They gave people an option based on their environmental score. And extensions were 2 to 5 years. Re-enrollment is a new contract, a 10 or 15-year contract. Unfortunately, acceptance rates, at least in the Prairie Pothole region, were fairly low. We ended up still losing about 855,000 acres of CRP just in 2007 in the Prairie Pothole region. Another 2 million acres are set to expire or 25% by October 1 of next year. And as we move to 2012, about 4.3, so just over 50% of our acres are set to expire. So we're still concerned, even though the re-enrollments and extensions were offered. If you look at some of those maps I've got that we did some analysis of CRP loss by county in the Prairie Pothole region, and some of those counties are going to lose over 75% of their CRP by 2012. So, some of those areas are in some of our best waterfowl breeding areas. So obviously, that's something that we're concerned about. And Nancy hit a little bit on it. Lots of different reasons why the acceptance rates for extensions and re-enrollments were low. I mean, commodity prices were on the upswing at that time, and a lot of them reached record levels in 2007. The CRP soil rental rates were not competitive with the rental rates that were being offered to lease that land out for farmland. And part of that relates to the way that USDA actually goes and looks at their how they calculate rental rates, and I can talk about that later if somebody has questions. And obviously more money could be made farming with the high commodity prices at that time, and that's the bottom line for a lot of the producers out there. So she mentioned that changes in the 2008 Farm Bill, prior to 2008 Farm Bill, in 2002 the nationwide cap for CRP was 39.2 million acres. That's the max could be in the program. It was reduced to 32 million acres in the 2008 Farm Bill, and they had to be there by this past October 1, so just last week. And they're actually down to 31.1 million acres right now, so we're below the 32 million acres. In addition to the CRP and the loss of CRP, we're obviously very concerned about native grassland loss. We continue to lose native prairie in the Prairie Pothole region in addition to the CRP. We've received information from the USDA, the Farm Service Agency, that we've lost nearly 380,000 acres of native prairie in the Prairie Pothole region of the Dakotas and Montana since 2002, and over 500,000 acres in those three different states statewide. So we're also concerned about that. Just to wrap up, looking forward, again, you know, obviously the global human population is going to continue to increase. We're at 6.8 billion people right now in the world. We're projections say we're going to be at 9 billion by the time we get to 2050. So obviously as that population increases, you know, there's going to be increased demand for food and fuel, fiber, energy, all those different things, and there's going to be increased pressure, you know, on natural resources to meet some of those demands. So we think the CRP program, if it's going to remain a viable option for producers, it's going to have to change. And when we talk about change, we're talking about more use on some of those acres to draw interest from people, that it's not just set aside land out there that they can't do anything with. One of the things that we talk a lot about in our office and in our region and work with conservation people on changing the mindset is some increased grazing management. Grazing, obviously managed hanging grazing gets a lot of negative press. We feel that grazing is very compatible with waterfowl production and nesting, a lot of nesting birds. I mean, we have a lot of birds nesting in native prey where there's grazing during the primary nesting season. So we think that more use, more regular use, let landowners incorporate that into their operation will be good. And as I said, it's very compatible with waterfowl production. We also think that there's practices, some new practices that could be installed that would allow biomass harvest rather for energy or cellulosic ethanol production. Again, we have lots of different practices, lots of different continuous practices. There's no reason why we can't create continuous practices to do that type of thing as well. And obviously, you'd have to utilize a few of the management practices to try to, you know, provide some of the best benefits you can for water quality, soil quality, and wildlife. But I think we can work through that. And as and I think there's a way especially in this budget climate, to have some savings for the government. As these producers would get to use this on a more regular basis, we could reduce their rental payments, you know, that are subsequently related to, you know, whatever economic gain they're able to make from that increased use. So just some thoughts on the way we're looking at this program going forward and how it's got to change if we think it's going to remain on the landscape.
Paul?
First of all, thank you all for coming. You're the brightest of the group in recognizing that agriculture is where it all is. I'd like to back up for just a minute and put what we're talking about today in some perspective. I don't think people understand the importance of the issues that we're talking about here. We've heard this morning a lot about the interconnectedness of things. People have been listening to John Muir, I guess, in the last couple of weeks on the National Parks thing. But anyway, just about everything we do with land impacts global climate issues. And so when we talk about global climate, we're not just talking about coal-fired power plants. We're talking about all of the things that we're doing. And if you look at agriculture, and I don't think people understand this or they haven't stopped to think about it, half of our land in the contiguous 48 states is in agriculture. That's about 1 billion acres out of the 2 billion acres that we have altogether in the contiguous 48. 70% of our land is in private hands, so only about 30% is in public hands. And when you get down to what we've been listening to on public television recently in the parks, that's a really tiny little bit of land that we say, okay, nature can go there, and the rest of it let's use. Well, we do use agriculture, and for 12,000 years now, we've been working to simplify the land. All these things we talk about land and its multiple functions and so on, agriculture, my occupation, has forced us or has driven us or we've been driven to simplify the land and to not allow anything out there except that one product that we want. And so we've moved in that direction. My state, Iowa, of course, is probably the best example of this. We don't have any land that doesn't get used. So you didn't see any national parks listed last week in Iowa. So then when we look at the 1 billion acres of land that's in agriculture, about 600 million are in grazing lands, pasture land and range land in the west. About 400 million acres are about 40% of ag land or 20% of our total land is in what we call row crops, land that we crop every year. CRP back in 1985 in order to balance production, we decided that, well, let's take some land out of production. Well, what land should we take out of production? Well, let's take the land that's most vulnerable. So we took the most highly erodible lands. Well, we said that if you have very highly erodible lands, we have this program where you can sign up for 10 years or 15 years in some cases, and we will pay you the ag rental rate if you don't farm it. So conservation, it was sort of equated with not farming. So this drive to simplify, we said, well, we'll hold off on a little bit of this. So we now have about 32 million acres in the Conservation Reserve Program, land retirement, and it's the most vulnerable land of all of the cropland we have in our country. And, of course, as we move towards needs for biofuels now and things like that, there's always the urge to say, well, let's open up a bit more of this. Back in the last campaign, all the politicians were talking about, you know, ethanol and biofuels solving our problems. And let's just, in fact, the proposals were for 30 billion gallons of biofuel by 2030. USDA, Forest Service, and ARS did a study on that and said, well, we can do it, but we need 36 million more acres. Guess what? We need CRP. And on top of that, we need 70% of the crop residue. Now we're getting to what we're talking about in global climate here, aren't we? If we take the most vulnerable lands out, we're no longer sequestering carbon. We're using resources, in fact, to grow it. We say that we're producing energy, but it's costing us a huge amount of energy to produce that energy. At the same time, we're moving very slowly on increasing efficiency on vehicles, although we've had quite a push in the last couple months. Put all this together, and that tells us where we are today. But what's most important about it, I think, is that agriculture, my occupation, has moved us. We move more and more towards dominating land and pushing wildness into smaller and smaller pieces. CRP, although it began as a way to stabilize prices, has evolved over the last 24 years into a really kind of exciting program. We're starting to look now at agriculture in a broader sense, that sure, we produce food and fiber and we can produce fuel, but we can also produce bluebirds and we can produce ducks and we can produce better water. In other words, agriculture becomes multifunctional when we start looking at it in those terms, and CRP has been the driving force for us doing that. We started out just planting brome grass in the Midwest. You know, even a self-respecting pheasant wouldn't want to walk in it after 5 years of stagnating without any nitrogen in it or anything. So, and today we've got native species coming back. We've got how we manipulate it in order to produce more waterfowl. We're using it for endangered species. And we're just beginning, if we really stop to think about it, think of what we could do. We could start targeting it more so that rather than 10% of the farms having it all, 90% of the farms may have some CRP in them if we did it right. We had a saying back in the 90s when we started the vegetative buffer initiative using CRP, put a strip of vegetation along a river or on a hillside to stop erosion and so on, farm the best and buffer the rest. Well, that's really where I hope this panel ends up today, is that maybe we can increase ethanol production in some areas, but we also really need to balance and look at the rest of the land and look at multifunctions that could come off of this land. So I would ask us as we go forward to think of, don't just get into the fight between these two guys and whether we want more ducks or we want more SUVs or something, I don't know. But rather, you know, let's get creative. And agriculture has got to do that. If it doesn't, look at where we're going. Iowa doesn't even tolerate a weed anymore. There's not even a buttonweed or a cocklebur or a thistle out there anymore. There is nothing but corn and soybeans. We are so good at it. And I'm not saying that's bad. But I'm saying along with that, if we could... In fact, we're in Aldo Leopold's territory here. Most of you are familiar with Aldo Leopold, although he was an Iowan. He was not a Wisconsin. He was born in Iowa. But anyway, you know, he wrote very eloquently about agriculture and about the importance of well, in fact, one of his major essays in the 1930s was, you know, we can grow anything on land if we just want to and if we learn to do it, if the signals are right to do it. Conservation is not a restraint on our freedoms. Conservation is a positive act, a creative act. CRP started as just really blah, but it is getting better, and I think with some effort we can really, really get excited about it. And I think that's where we have to go, and as we go there, it's not just the United States but the world needs to figure out whether the most productive lands in the world are a place where wildness can be as well as what we need to produce our food and fiber and fuel. So.
Well, I'm honored to be on this panel. Thank you, Nancy, for inviting me to be here. I have a lot of respect for Scott and Ducks Unlimited. I've worked with Ducks Unlimited in previous life and other wildlife and conservation organizations, and clearly Paul Johnson has unique experience that gives him unique credibility on this issue. And so I think everything he said was wise as well. If it's expected of me to fight or to be the token ethanol guy who thinks every piece of ground needs to be planted to corn, I'm going to disappoint you, because that's not the opinion that I have. I think CRP has been the most popular and the most effective conservation program ever. I agree with Paul and Scott. It started out as a land retirement program because prices were low. But it has evolved and it has improved, and like anything, it will probably need to undergo some changes in order to continue to be successful. But I intend to focus more on areas where we have common ground than occasional differences of opinion. The truth of the matter is it's critically important in this country that we protect our soil, that we reduce erosion, that we improve water quality, and that we provide habitat for wildlife. It's also critically important in this country that we reduce our fossil fuel use. It's dangerous for our environment. It's costly for us as motorists. And it's bad for our economy and our energy security. I reject the idea that the interests of biofuels and the conservation community are incompatible, that we are fighting each other, that this is a zero-sum game. The free market doesn't protect either of our interests right now. For biofuels, because oil has a de facto monopoly on the transportation fuel supply, and left to their own devices, oil companies would rather not use something that displaces something they own that they make. My industry relies on public policies to crack open that market for the alternative, ethanol in this example. And so we rely on those public policies. At the same time, the so-called free market doesn't place enough value on conservation practices to encourage landowners to adopt the kinds of conservation practices that are meaningful, that are long-term, that put some of these more sensitive lands into a program that protects our resources. And so conservation interests rely on public policies. And so we're both asking Congress and state legislatures and governors to help protect our interests, provide a market for biofuels, provide some sound, wise, meaningful conservation practices. Is there going to be friction between these two because we both rely upon the land, as Paul said? Absolutely, there's going to be some friction, and I wouldn't deny that. But I also think that there is some balance that needs to be achieved, and there will be some times when this is imperfect. There will be times when ethanol zealots, like some did in 2008 when corn prices went to $7 a bushel, said, we need to see all this land terminate from their CRP contracts because, by golly, we've got to plant more corn to this land. My organization didn't say that. We didn't lobby the United States Department of Agriculture to allow for penalty-free exiting of land from the CRP. We didn't ask Congress to do that. There are, you know, conservation interests that would rather not see, you know, corn being planted for the purposes of ethanol. And what we've got to do is sort of ignore the noise on the extremes and work in the common ground middle. Just to give you, as I close, and I look forward to questions and the discussion, some a little bit about my background, because I think it is unique and lends to this common ground. I grew up on a farm and a ranch in central South Dakota. We used to farm a piece of ground that our church owned that, instead of paying rent to us, they decided that they could earn more by enrolling it in the CRP. And so my father and I planted some brome grass and a few other things on that quarter section of land, and hunted that CRP land quite a bit. And I have witnessed firsthand how EQIP practices installed or adopted on our farm and around the country and around our county have improved soil quality, wildlife habitat. When I worked for Senator Tim Johnson, who is a United States Senator from the state of South Dakota, I helped write a bill to increase the CRP cap to 45 million acres. In 2002, as a staffer for Senator Johnson, I worked with Senator Daschle's office to write the Farmable Wetlands Pilot Program. It's sort of a sub-program within CRP that allows some wetlands that in some years, in dry years, don't hold any water, but in wet years certainly do. It allows farmers, instead of plowing through that land, it allows them to enroll that land into the continuous sign-up part of CRP. And protect that land. Now, obviously, I work for the biofuels industry, but I'm not going to wear the black hat today, and I'm not going to attack the importance of the conservation program. I realize that, you know, there will be some friction, but I think we can and should and must find some common ground. I think there are some protections in place today that prevent the wholesale removal of land from CRP, and I think it's rhetorically as dangerous to say that biofuels are going to ruin CRP as it is rhetorically dangerous to say that CRP ruins economies in rural communities. And when I was a staffer for Tim Johnson, we'd get a lot of letters from small town bankers and farm equipment dealers and others who said, you know, if you guys continue to push CRP and increase the cap to 45 million acres, there won't be any farmers left in my community, and they won't buy any equipment, and they won't ask for any loans from the bank, and you're going to ruin small town America. That didn't happen, and that's nonsense. And so we've got to block out the noise and work together, and that's what we would encourage. And so I'm really thrilled to be on the panel. I'm looking forward to questions and the discussion. So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you each for excellent introductions to the topic. Let's start for a moment, though, with ethanol. You've heard the numbers of how much more acreage would be necessary to meet some of our goals in terms of ethanol production. Where do you see, Brian, that going? Do you see that we'll shift away from corn sooner, or how are we going to get there, and how is that going to impact available acreage?
Sure. I don't think we're going to shift away from corn anytime soon, because unfortunately we haven't yet been able to crack the code to make cellulosic biofuel commercially competitive. We're getting closer and closer every day. There are some exciting developments, especially with respect to wood chips and corn cobs. There are a lot of biomass type feedstocks that people are working on, but we're not quite there yet. We've got to get there, and I'll be the first to tell you we recognize there are limits on how much corn can and should be used to make ethanol. However, I also think that we will continue to see the corn ethanol industry evolve. It's going to get more efficient, When it comes to where are we going to find the land to satisfy the increased demand, I don't see as much, and Scott makes a good point. There's some land coming out of the CRP in the eastern Dakotas that could go into some corn and soybean production. There's no doubt about that. But I don't see as much focus on removing land from CRP in order to plant corn to it, for instance, to satisfy ethanol demand, as much as I see shifting of acres on other cropland. We see reduced soybean acres in this country because of the demand for corn for ethanol. We see a shift away where it can make sense from cotton acres in this country in order to plant corn for ethanol. And the other factor is, I don't know how long I have to answer the question, but the last thing I want to mention is our yield increases. And I'm not going to say yield increases are the silver bullet savior, but it's incredible the advances that have been made by farmers in terms of producing more bushels of corn, for example, on the same acres. In 2007, the United States produced a record 13.1 billion bushels of corn. The average yield of that corn was something like, Paul, I think it was like 151 or 154 bushels to the acre. This year, 2009, we have planted 6.5 million acres less land to corn. 6.5 million acres less land to corn than we did in 2007. But the average yield anticipated by the Department of Agriculture is between 160 and 164 bushels to the acre. And so we're going to produce the same 13 billion bushels of corn this year that we did in 2007, not by expanding the amount of land we planted to corn, actually with a reduction in the amount of land we planted to corn. And so I think that's an important point to make, and I'll be quiet so you can ask more questions.
That's great. Thank you. And then another question for other two panelists. Where do you see CRP policy going? Do you see a successful effort to lower the acreage, or do you see it going back up or remaining static? And if it's not headed the direction you want to see it go, what changes politically need to be made to make that happen? Does that make sense?
Well, obviously, I mean, I would hope that it doesn't continue to decrease. I mean, we weren't necessarily pleased with the drop to 32 million acres, you know, considering that we were at just over 36 in 2006. So we're at 31 now. We've lost 5 million acres of pretty important habitat out there. And as Paul mentioned, a lot of this stuff is, you know, a lot of the stuff that is enrolled in CRP, it was enrolled through an environmental benefits index. It's some of the most marginal environmentally sensitive lands that we have out there. So we hope, as we will continue to work with the administration on ways to maintain it at 32 million acres. I mean, we're down below that already. We need to figure out a way. USDA is going through a supplemental environmental impact statement right now on CRP. We need to figure out a way to get general sign-ups back into the mix. Some of these continuous practices that Paul talked about that are so important because they're targeted at specific environmental issues. You know, whether it's buffer initiatives or we have one in the Dakotas called the Duck Nesting Habitat Initiative that's focused in areas where we have our highest waterfowl breeding areas. Those types of things, those all need to be part of the mix, and we're going to continue to work with Congress and the administration to make sure that we don't drop significantly below the 32 million acres.
I think that we usually don't change until we have a crisis of some sort, and we're moving towards that now, perhaps. And certainly the wildlife folks who really got involved in agriculture back from about 1985 on with the conservation programs beginning to realize, hey, that's where the ducks are, and that's where the pheasants are, and that's where the whitetails are, have really mobilized and are a very important factor in ag policy today, and I think that's exciting and that's really good. But as I mentioned earlier, we're just beginning to get really creative with the CRP concept, the idea of some land retirement. And we have programs like a wetland reserve program today that we haven't talked about it, but it's comparable to the CRP. CRP often went in and took fairly large acreages, and I know the CRP around my farm, the land that's in CRP, it's probably at least 25 to 30% of it could be farmed very easily and very well. But whole fields were taken out and whole sections were taken out in some areas with CRP. And that's very, very good if you want nesting songbirds and things like that, and I think we need that. But we also have opportunities to do a lot of other things. As mentioned, the continuous sign-up, which is small pieces of land in farmed wetlands, in buffers along rivers and streams, waterways, things like that. And we could do a lot more of that even. I've been pushing for years for a partial field enrollment that it would go to a continuous, and maybe it would be limited by no more than, say, 10% of a field or something like that. But in much of farmland, especially here in Wisconsin and spilling in every direction, every farm could use some CRP. There's probably 10% of the land on most farms that's producing 70% of the problems or is the most vulnerable. And so if we could go out onto a, and I'll use my farm as an example, I could probably put 50 acres of CRP and that would provide some habitat. It wouldn't be what we need in terms of the large nesting areas, but it certainly could provide some. It would really improve water quality going through and past my farm. It would Pheasants Forever in Iowa used to say that what we really want is to flush a pheasant and have no pheasant in Iowa flushed that can't find another place to land that's wild. Well, picture a state like Iowa with buffers along rivers and streams and better waterways that have more diversity in them and small partials of fields here and there everywhere that we could bring back to wildness. We could certainly put 35, 40 million acres of CRP across the land that would not be the same as it is today. It would certainly provide more of the really productive land back into production, perhaps. So I don't want to leave the impression, though, that we don't need large tracts. We do, but not all of them. So.
All right, we'll turn the questions over to you and look forward to hearing from you.
Gustav. I have a question for Scott. I come from Minnesota. We've got a pretty big duck problem in Minnesota. Versus 50 years ago, our duck population is like one-fifth of what it was. And we have a very ambitious duck plan to rebuild our duck population. And that plan could totally unravel with the CRP losses that are projected. So as I look at the chart that you handed out, I wonder if you've taken this chart of CRP acreage loss to the next step as far as what that means in terms of duck production. How many fewer ducks do we see? Are we talking about waterfowl season closures?
Yeah.
I'll restate the question.
Okay.
So your question is, just for the purposes of our recording and for the others, is what are the losses that we're seeing? How is that going to translate in actual losses in wild waterfowl, is that right? Okay.
It's a good question, but it's a difficult one to answer because we've got so much climate variability in our part of the country, which is really important. I mean, those dry years that we have are the most important part of the cycle that we have. I mean, that's what restores the vegetation to these wetlands so that when they get wet again, we've got invertebrate production, and that's what the birds are there to eat when they get there. So with that climate variability, I mean, it makes it a little bit hard to project exactly what it means. What we do know is that as the grass disappears off the landscape and, the birds are forced in, if the wetlands are still there, they're still going to come. And so if they're forced into the small fragments of habitat that are left, and this is why the larger blocks that Paul talked about are so important to us, when they get forced into those fragments, it's easier for predators to find where they're nesting, and so predation rates are pretty high and populations go down. So we do know that happens. And, waterfowl are long-lived birds. They're a little bit different than pheasants. I mean, pheasants, on average, you're talking about a three-year lifespan, for most of them. So waterfowl, there's many documented cases of mallards, well over 10 years. So they've got a longer-term reproduction strategy. When it's dry, they kind of sit on the sidelines and don't do much. And when it gets wet, they, produce a lot of birds. And, of course, those ducklings that are raised, they come back. And so there's a compounding effect. So it gets a little bit difficult, but we do know that as we lose that habitat and birds are forced into smaller areas in larger numbers, that predation rates will go up, and we tend to, you know, our populations we expect to decrease significantly.
Repeat the question. What effect will sustainable agriculture production have on CRP?
I think that it will certainly utilize small bits of CRP like the continuous sign-up. They fit very well into a farm that's trying to put a lot of conservation onto the land as well, the sustainable agriculture movement. Sustainable agriculture, as we know it today, is still a very small part of agriculture in general, although Monsanto now says it promotes sustainable agriculture, so it won't be long before we'll all be there. But I think that, again, if we could get more creative about the use of land retirement, or, as was mentioned by Scott, partial use of land, why does it have to be a 10-year or a 15-year? Why can't it be a 3-year rotation as part of a rotation to set aside a percentage of your land? And remember, the people say, well, that's expensive, but the results of good conservation are commodities too, and the American public really wants them. We want biodiversity in this land, don't we? And we want cleaner water and things like this. And if we could start looking at agriculture in terms of producing conservation commodities as well as the traditional food and fiber, it would really be a boost to the sustainable agriculture movement. But what it could also mean then is that we bring new ideas. The CSP program, the Conservation Security, is that what it's called today? Program is trying to do that.
Stewardship.
Security was before, now it's stewardship. But that's trying to do this kind of thing, bring the idea that agriculture is more than just food and fiber, that agriculture is the stewardship of most of the productive land in this world. And so I think as we go through this big discussion and these arguments that are taking place today, we maybe have an opportunity to turn on some light bulbs, compact fluorescent or LED, but get us to start thinking more creatively. And the Chicago Board of Trade is not going to give us money for bluebirds, but there's no reason why the American public can't enter that marketplace. And that's what CRP was originally, or that's certainly what it's evolving into. We would like to lease this land from farmers and hire them to produce conservation commodities on these pieces of land for this amount of time. That's how we got to start looking at it. And I think once we do, we could really get excited, couldn't we, about the kinds of things that we could do. And it isn't one or the other. It's all of these things. Multifunctional agriculture. Say that. Everybody say it. So.
And if you could, please, when you ask your question, please introduce yourself and your organization. Mark?
Mark Schlefstein, Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Can you all address a little bit about the relationship between conservation reserve and the reductions that have been occurring and the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, especially, not to mention other areas that also have problems with nutrient runoff from former conservation?
Well, just very briefly, the research certainly shows that it's probably nitrogen is the primary culprit, but phosphorus to a certain extent as well, that really the only way to lessen this is to get perennial crops back onto some of that land, whether it be hay or pasture or CRP wildlife habitat or things like this, I think are going to help. We can do a lot still in fine-tuning the way we grow crops, but I think that's very important. But another part of it that's very important is restoring wetlands within an ag drainage system. North Central Iowa has about 800,000 miles of drain tile under it. We've got about a 4 million acre, the Des Moines lobe area. It goes up into Minnesota, right in the prairie pothole area. That all used to be wetlands. And today, you can't even find a mosquito anymore. They've really done an amazing job. They're about to redo that. Most of that drainage was put in back 50, 70, 80 years ago. It's in need of restructuring. We really ought to be putting hundreds and hundreds of wetlands back into that drainage system. And it doesn't have to take that many acres. Now, that may not be the best thing for a pair of ducks but in some areas it will work well. But unless we start processing that water that's going through those drain tiles, we're not going to solve the problem with the Gulf, I don't think. And that's either done by soil functioning better than it is when we have an annual crop that gets a huge dose of nitrogen every year, or it's going to have some wetlands back into it to slow that water down and process it and extract some of those nutrients. Both of those things are exciting. Just think of what you could do if you had a chance to redesign agriculture in north central Iowa. Wow. We drained what agriculture used to call wasteland, your land. In fact, they still have the term wasteland on the census. We got to change that. And then we turned it into the most productive land the world has ever seen. It is amazing. Now, but along with that, look at the problems we have associated with it. Think about what we could do now, given some of the even elementary knowledge that we have in terms of redesigning that drainage system so that we could continue to be really productive and produce corn ethanol and produce, I don't know if we want more corn sweeteners, but produce typical agriculture products, and at the same time add some wildness back into that landscape by bringing that water to the surface periodically and letting wildness occur back on that landscape. It would really be something if we could. And now's the time to start really thinking about it. And now's the time for Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever and Trout Unlimited and all of these groups to really get excited, not just about traditional old CRP, but new creative ways of redesigning the landscape so that we can have it all. I think that's our challenge.
Are you asking, is the rate of loss greater or different than it was in previous eras? Okay.
Yeah, there's really no way to look at that. Even if you look at, some of the NRCS data that's out there from their National Resource Inventory, there's a little, as Paul mentioned, they've got rangeland, pastureland, and there's kind of an overlap there of trying to decide what's, never been tilled, what has been tilled, what category they fit into. But I don't know that it's directly related to the corn production. I think it goes back to what Brian was talking about with the shifting of acres. As people shift acres from whether it's wheat or sunflowers or soybeans into corn production, obviously when commodity prices were high, that affects worldwide markets. There's droughts other places. Grain stocks go down. And, of course, they're looking to replace those acres that they've now got in corn with other acres. And so that's where some of the native prairie gets tilled up. And there's policies in place within the Farm Bill that particularly the risk management programs like crop insurance and disaster assistance programs that take away a lot of the risk of farming some of these marginal areas. And I should have included a couple photos of some of the areas we're talking about. I mean, these are areas that are largely glaciated. I mean, rocks the size of Volkswagens that are being picked out. I mean, it's not some of your best soils out there. And of course, we worked in the Farm Bill to try to get that fixed through a sod saver provision that would have required folks to earn a yield on that over a period of years before they actually were eligible for things like crop insurance and disaster assistance. And we're unsuccessful, but continuing to work forward. And I don't think that serves any part of the American public well. To be bringing more and more of these acres in to production and adding to our, you know, problems with water quality and additional soil erosion. And so I think I surely don't blame a farmer for doing that. The incentives are there for them to do that. They're trying to make a living out there, and we just need to fix some of those policies so that that doesn't happen.
Nancy, if I could add to that, I think Scott made some great points, and the truth is there absolutely are some lands in CRP that have never been cropped. They're pasture land, and one thing that the 2007 energy bill contains, a provision in that energy bill, in an attempt to prevent that sort of land from going into corn or soybean production for the sole purpose of producing a feedstock that's then used for biofuels, is a provision called an existing cropland provision. And I recognize it's going to be very difficult for EPA to enforce, and it will require them to cooperate with the United States Department of Agriculture, NRCS, and others. But it forbids a crop like corn or a commodity like corn or soybeans from qualifying for biofuel production if that land has never been in cropland prior to the passage of that bill. Now, again, there are some enforcement and administrative questions that are very legitimate as to how you identify that. But I just wanted to point out that's a protection, if you will, that's built into the energy bill.
I should also add one other thing: the biomass crop assistance program, which is a new program that was in the 2008 Farm Bill, also has provisions in there on eligibility criteria for land that don't allow lands that have never previously been tilled to be tilled up to produce, you know, even a perennial grass crop for the biomass crop assistance program. So we're working on some of these policy issues, and that's going to be the key to solving some of that. I mean, as I mentioned, I surely don't blame landowners for making the decisions. I mean, those are the policies in place, and those are the tools that they have at their disposal. So we just need to raise the awareness and try to fix some of those issues.
Unfortunately, we've had other problems, and they've been associated with CRP and a number of programs like that, you don't qualify for these programs unless you have been cropping the land.
Right.
So we've actually had a number of examples. We still have them today, although they've tightened it up a bit, but people go in and plow up land that should never have been plowed up, simply so they could eventually get it back into CRP and get paid for it. On the other hand, we have no programs for them right now, so this may be land. I mean, many of us have lands that really are not very productive right now, but all we can do is to plow them up and plant corn in them or put a crop on them. There are no conservation programs for them if they're already in perennial crops. And so farmers have, I mean, I can understand them doing it. I've never done it, but I can understand them plowing up land so that they could get to that point. I think we need to come in there before that, and that's what the Conservation Stewardship Program helps with a little bit. It starts rewarding them for the good things they have done, not just putting a bandage on something after they've made a real problem. So
the other program that is out there, that, and Paul didn't talk about it, but it's a grassland reserve program that NRCS have. It's been horribly underfunded. It's targeted to do the type of things that Paul's talking about, to try to provide payments to these guys to protect that, you know, that pasture land or native prairie in perpetuity. The Fish and Wildlife Service, they have a perpetual grassland easement program that provides money. There's carbon payments. I mean, again, we're trying to figure out ways to make that type of agriculture as competitive, and, you know, leave them some options to maybe not necessarily have to just till it and put it into corn or beans or whatever it might be. So there's some things that need to be worked through to make it an economically viable option for them.
Do you have a question?
Expanding corn fields that are So the question is, how can some existing farmers, such as tobacco and cotton farmers, retool their farms so that they could be productive for corn ethanol? Is that right? Start with you, Brian.
I've got to be honest with you. I'm not familiar enough with land in the Carolinas or Virginia that was formerly used to produce tobacco, whether that's suitable for corn, for ethanol, or corn to feed. You know, what they might be more interested in, frankly, if they're going to plant corn in the Carolinas or Virginia, is probably corn for poultry or corn for the pork industry. There's not much of a biofuel sector there yet. You probably will see in that part of the country, to be honest with you, if there is a move to produce biofuels, it will be from, biomass products. And so I'm going to plead ignorant a little bit on, I don't know what Congress or states have done to sort of help those landowners retool since the market isn't there for tobacco to plant another crop. But again, in terms of ethanol, I would be suspect to say there's a surging interest there. I think it's more, if they're going to plant it to corn, it'll be for livestock feed. Maybe these gentlemen have a better answer.
Well, unfortunately, the rental rates or crop rental rates for tobacco land are considerably higher. If you solve that problem, then we can solve it in Afghanistan and Colombia as well, probably, on some of these crops. So that is a really tough issue to deal with, and I think it has to go beyond just shifting it to an ethanol, and it's just going to have to be a transition probably from a crop that was very, very lucrative. Of course, it's hard work, and we don't have very many crops that will match that other than perhaps vegetable cropping in some cases.
Any other questions? Could one of you explain, so to the extent in case someone here isn't aware of it, kind of the success story we had in the past year or so? There was tremendous pressure to convert CRP land to crop land and to pull it out of enrollment, and the pressure on the USDA to do that. Could one of you explain, maybe Paul, since you're familiar with it, what the rules were and how people asked the government to kind of break the rules and how the government responded?
Actually, probably Scott.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, the rules are pretty explicit when you look through USDA's handbooks on how they provide penalties. As far as basically you have to return all your annual payments that you receive. Some of those contracts have been in place, as way back to when the program began. You know, they've been re-enrolled a couple of different times. They're 20 years old, so that's a lot of money. There's interest penalties as well, and all the incentive payments, cost share, all that type of stuff. And of course, that was being, most of you are familiar with what was going on. That was being asked that those penalties be waived, and they just be able to go ahead and turn this land over and start farming it. To USDA's credit, they held strong on it. They have specific environmental criteria that are in place on some practices that are simply not eligible for an early out, no matter what. Some of it's wetland practices, buffer practices. They provided the wildlife community and a lot of other folks the opportunity to provide input on this as far as what land shouldn't be eligible and why we thought it wasn't a good idea. These are, again, as we've talked about, these are mostly, for the most part, marginal lands, environmentally sensitive lands, and not the kind of lands that we necessarily want to be turning back over and putting them into production. So, that issue comes up regularly whenever commodity prices are high. This isn't an isolated incident. It happened in 95 and 96, and there was actually some acres that did come out, but they were replaced with additional environmentally sensitive lands. So, it's not the last time we'll hear this. I mean, I've even heard some folks at our state technical committee meetings in North Dakota this year even asking for early outs, and there's really no reason for it this year. But so it comes up regularly.
Could I add something to that?
at the risk of offending landowners, Scott made a great point. Commodity prices ebb and flow. They experience peaks and valleys, and that's been true for as long as farmers have been producing commodities. And, you know, if a landowner was foolish enough to think that $7 corn was going to be perpetual, and he was foolish enough to suffer through the penalties and losing some of the incentives to take land out to plant it to corn for ethanol or whatever else because he or she thought $7 corn was going to continue, I mean, that's absurd. And you're seeing now corn prices are back down to about $3 a bushel, so less than half what they were. And there's enormous interest in conservation programs. I think we need to plow more investment into them, frankly. I thought it was the conservation security program, too, but it's conservation stewardship. Well, I think didn't USDA announce just earlier this week, farmers or landowners subscribed, applied like 30-some million acres worth of land that they wanted to enroll in the program. Well, it's going to be limited, it sounds like, to something like 12 or 13 million acres. So there's got to be more focus on putting value on the things that Paul and Scott are talking about and enabling farmers to understand that they can, landowners, I should say, that they can get a value for entering into these conservation practices and keep that land in those practices long term.
Just a quick comment, too. One of the reasons CRP has held up so well is because of groups that really raise hell when there's an effort to try to weaken the programs. And Ducks Unlimited, and Pheasants Forever, and groups like that, they've really weighed in, and it's been amazing. When I was in Washington and these things would constantly come up, it just, you know, I never would have believed that we could stop some of the things that people were interested in doing to weaken the programs. They were stopped because of relatively small groups of people who knew their stuff and who made a good case for it. That impressed me about Ken Burns' series on the national parks, too. It wasn't mass movements that gave us our national parks. It was relatively few people who really fought hard. And I would compliment those of you in journalism who get this word out, because it doesn't have to be the whole nation knowing everything before we do anything. It can be relatively few people that stop something bad from happening or can really initiate something good. And that's our hope, I think.
And just to follow up, I mean, I've had a few landowners that I've talked to in North Dakota this year that are thankful that opportunity wasn't allowed, because it's not good land, and they still are in CRP. They're continuing to get their payments. You know, corn prices, as Brian mentioned, have dropped, as all commodity prices have. And they're glad that they didn't take those steps. And, you know, I think it's the heat of the moment. It's as prices are going up, and, you know, there's an opportunity to make some money there. And as I mentioned earlier, CRP, USDA needs to do some work on, you know, how they calculate what the rental rates are. Right now they look at it's just not responsive to high commodity prices. When commodity prices go up, they go up rather rapidly in a short period of time. And FSA is looking at a three-year previous window of what that average rental rate is. Well, if you're looking at a three-year lag, there's just no way that you're going to be anywhere close to what's happening out on the landscape now. And then it's an easy decision for the landowner. Okay, I'm getting $80 an acre over here to rent this out, or I can get $35 an acre for CRP. It's a no-brainer. And so there's some things that need to happen in how they calculate rental rates, too, to make it a competitive option. If it's competitive and they're able to make, you know, a decent living off of it, they're not going to consider things like early outs. So there's some things there that need to be addressed.
Any more questions? Yeah.
I'm Elizabeth McGowan. I'm a freelance writer in Washington, D.C., and I just kind of have a hypothetical futuristic question that I think about, and I wanted to get your perspective. If this cellulosic ethanol, indeed, we find answers with native grasses and forbs that we can use for transportation fuel, can you envision a future where farmers are growing this crop, I don't know if it would be their full farm or just partial, and then you use like a crop rotation and just harvest some of it. So you're fulfilling this sort of CRP need and the fuel needs on enormous acreage and harvesting on a schedule to allow for, you know, bird nesting and migration and all that. I mean, is that a possibility in this country, even if it's just done regionally and not maybe nationally? I mean,
Is it possible to kind of marry these two things through cellulosic ethanol so that farmers can rotate the production of the perennial grasses and produce ethanol and the wildlife that we're looking for?
It's in play right now. I mentioned it earlier. The Biomass Crop Assistance Program is kind of that first stab at that. We worked closely with Senator Thune's office on he had called it the Biofuels Innovation Program at that time, and then Congressman Colin Peterson's staff came up with the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, which in the final conference it ended up something that was kind of a combination of two. But that's basically the idea, is to start it out as a pilot program, pick areas of the country where you've got a current biorefinery or a biorefinery that's actually in the works in the future plans, and trying to get landowners to enroll in that. There's payments for enrolling in that. There's payments for actually establishing the crops, the harvesting, the transportation. Again, all of this to try to get this industry stimulated. And at the same time, there are best management practices in place that talk about, okay, there's some reserves over here that won't be harvested every year. There's talk about some different stubble heights that it's cut at, harvest times, all this type of thing to try to, obviously, and we surely don't believe that you could, the whole point of that program is not to optimize wildlife benefits. Can we get some secondary benefits for wildlife with some management practices? Definitely. The whole idea is to try to jumpstart the cellulosic ethanol industry and the bioenergy industry, and realizing that as we put grass on the landscape, we're going to get some benefits for wildlife, we're going to get benefits for water quality, we're going to get better benefits for erosion control and those kinds of things. I mean, I think it's a perfect fit for some of the things that Paul was talking about when we talk about, you know, addressing the dead zone, you know, and the need for wetland restoration. Well, if you go into part of Iowa where you've got some of this drainage tile that's been severely degraded that needs to be replaced, I mean, you wouldn't have to replace that tile if you went in and, as part of a biomass crop assistance program or some other program, had perennial grasses out there that are providing an income for the ethanol industry. They're addressing some of these nutrient runoff issues. Wetlands become an asset because they help irrigate some of those crops. Your yields go up. I mean, there's ways to make this work, and I think, as Brian said earlier, I mean, it does none of us any good to be at odds with one another over this. The key is to try to figure out how we can make it all work. How can we all compromise and make this work? And there's a lot of areas that are crop that definitely should never be in anything but crop production. I mean, they're some of the most productive soils in the world, and how do we make some of these more marginal areas fit into the income streams for these landowners? I believe it's started with the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, but I only see that growing.
I'm no fan of large animal confinement systems, but we have a lot of manure in very small area. In Iowa, most of it sits on top of ag drainage, in fact, and so we're spreading at a time of the year when there's no soil or no plants occupying the soil, late fall, early spring. I mean, it's a recipe for a dead zone in the Gulf. If we had more perennial crops out there and being able to apply animal manures to those to increase production. We're not interested right now in really increasing that broom grass, but we could if we were also harvesting it for cellulosic, if we ever get there. Then you could put together a system that would work together rather than each piece causing serious problems like we are right now. So right now I don't believe you're usually allowed to put animal waste on CRP land, are you? Renee, or I don't think so. So it's one of those things where we consider it almost a waste right now, or a way to get rid of animal manures. It's better if it could be put on a crop that you're harvesting, but it could really be a lot better if it were put on a perennial crop, because then soil would be functioning properly and those plants would be taking up that nutrient. It wouldn't be leaching through that rapidly and getting into our drain tiles and into our streams and down the Mississippi.
I would just briefly add that there's a lot of excitement with some about cellulosic biofuel. There's a lot of work going on, as I mentioned earlier, in the area of corn cobs and wood chips, significant interest in grasses that can be harvested within reason for that. We honestly don't know how that will shake out yet. None of it is commercially viable today, unfortunately. And so I think Scott's right. The BCAP as a pilot to help us identify if this is one way we can make it work and achieve a few other benefits in addition to biomass, you know, for fuels as well is important. But you know, a word of caution: it's trendy to talk about making ethanol from stuff, municipal waste, and corn cobs, and please don't get me wrong, we've got to do it if we are going to make a meaningful difference in clean energy and pollution control and energy security. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done yet to make that happen.
All right, I want to thank all of you for coming and our panelists for agreeing to participate. I do appreciate it. Thank you.